Hey everyone, welcome back to Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast. I'm your host, Mike Wong. Several years ago, I got an email from a writer who was developing a book about science and science fiction. Specifically, the way we imagine alien life through the lens of speculative fiction, and how that compares and contrasts to the state of the art in terms of our scientific understanding of life in the universe. I had a wonderful chat with this author, whose name was Jamie Green, talking about my research as an astrobiologist and my love of Star Trek. When it came time for us to hang up our Zoom call, I told her that I can't wait to read her book and have her aboard my podcast to discuss it. And she said she'd love that, but that I should probably give her like 3 to 4 years. Well, 3 to 4 years later, I didn't forget my promise. Jamie's book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos, hit bookshelves last year. And over the holidays, I picked up a copy of the book from Politics and Prose, my local independent bookshop here in Washington, D.C., and I read it almost in a blur. It was a real page-turner for me, not just because it was so well-written, but also because I couldn't wait to see what familiar Star Trek episode, sci-fi novel, or scientist was on the next page. Truly, this was one of those books I wish didn't have to end. So there's only one surefire way to keep the magic of a book alive, and it's to talk about it with someone, especially on a podcast that you can share with everyone else in the world. So today, we have a real treat on Strange New Worlds. It's a conversation with the author of The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos, the one and only Jamie Green. Ready? Engage. Jamie Green, welcome to Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Jamie, first of all, congratulations on writing such a beautiful and thought-provoking book, which I have right here in my hand, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. This was one of the most enjoyable reads I've ever had. And, you know, obviously the subject matter really speaks to my interests, but I also just found the prose so absolutely beautiful and stirring. So to kick us off, I'd love to give our audience just a little bit of a taste of this. Jamie, would you mind reading the last section of the prologue for us?
Not at all. I totally forgot about this. Let me grab the book. The UK version is what's at hand.
Okay.
So, but it's the same, totally the same on the inside. So space is indescribably vast. Planets orbit, stars burn, and the black hole at the center of the Milky Way devours all without a care for our existence. We're just a speck, just a flicker of matter organizing itself in a funny way for a bit of time. We take our smallness as proof of both our insignificance and our great importance. For all that we imagine, Earth is the only planet we know of with life. It's a terrible burden to contemplate that this might be the only life in the cosmos. A huge responsibility for such a clumsy species to bear and such a lonely universe to live in. We want to know if we matter. We want to know what our existence means. Life on another world would give us a context, a foil, a richer way of understanding ourselves. So we search and listen, calculate the odds. But ultimately, we can only speculate about how we fit into the galactic picture. Through it all, our visions of alien worlds are reflections of ourselves, arising from our research, our dreams, and our subconscious like mist from a field at dawn. When we imagine a dozen ways for an alien to be, we're imagining a dozen different kinds of people. When we invent alien languages, we learn more about the human brain. When we dream of a benevolent visitation, we're telling a story of what we think we need. In a novel about imagination shaping the world, The Lathe of Heaven, Ursula K. Le Guin wrote, "What will the creature made all of sea drift do on the dry sand of daylight? What will the mind do each morning waking? If these imaginings are dreams, the science and stories both, what stays with us when we wake?" Imagining extraterrestrial life is a way of figuring out what it means to be a conscious animal, what it means to be matter and alive. Our visions of space are a reflection of ourselves and of our humanity, like the building blocks of a telescope, a mirror, and a lens.
Oh, that is just so lovely, especially that last line there, how our telescope is both a mirror for ourselves and a lens to see what might be out there. You know, it really resonates with me, this idea that when we look for alien life in the cosmos, we're also looking very profoundly for what is inside of us, what we are as living beings, because we still really don't know what life is. But yeah. I've never heard it put so beautifully before. So I really wanted,
that was
so great.
Thank you.
Right after the end of the prologue, you jump straight into Star Trek.
Yeah.
I didn't think it could get even better. Yeah. So chapter one of your book is basically like an episode of this show, which blends science and Star Trek, but it's even better. So you bring up three Star Trek episodes in this chapter: the Next Generation episode, The Chase, to talk about panspermia, the TNG episode, All Good Things, to talk about the origin of life, and the original series episode, Devil in the Dark, to talk about the possibility of silicon-based life. You begin this chapter with the line, "Of course, we start with Star Trek." Jamie, how did you know that you had to begin your book with Star Trek? And what was that feeling like?
I mean, it's a couple of things. Like, the fact that I wrote this book, I think, begins with Star Trek. I think begins with my dad turning on The Next Generation when I was 7 or 8 years old. But also, that line was like, you're like seeing my writing process there, where I basically was tricking myself into starting the chapter. You know, I was like, when I wrote that line, I didn't mean that it would necessarily make it to the final version of the book. It was like, okay, here we go. Of course, we start with Star Trek. It was just like to myself in a way. But then as I sat with it, like after I finished the writing that day, I was like, kind of fond of that line. I kind of like that. I think I might have written the real first line of my book, because it feels true in so many ways. And I think that, like, from a writing perspective, I'm hoping that it sets the tone and the expectations for the reader of, like, this is not straightforward science journalism. You know, I'm an essayist. I'm in it as not a character, but like a personality and a point of view. So I liked, as a writing thing, sort of bringing the reader in and sort of in the middle of a thought, because it's in the middle of my lifetime of thinking about these things.
That totally makes sense. I also was introduced to Star Trek by sitting on the couch with my dad. So did you grow up with TNG and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and all that stuff too?
It was TNG, because I was watching it like as it aired. So now everyone knows exactly how old I am. I think I probably started around season 3 or 4. And my guess is, you know, I was 7 or 8 when those seasons were airing. And so we watched Next Generation all the way through. And so it was very much like a core, like, you know, spine of my relationship with my dad, is we watched that. And so we didn't end up watching Deep Space Nine, because that started airing before Next Generation was over. So we had our show. We also then got into X-Files, and then we started watching Voyager. And I vividly remember the episode that we were both like, okay, we're done with this show. I don't remember the name of it, but it's the one where Janeway and Paris get turned into lizards and have lizard babies.
Yes.
You know, that's like, I think that's a classic, like, okay. And I know there's also a lot of love for that episode, but I think as it was airing, we were, and I, you know, by then I was probably in high school, and like I was, you know, busier doing activities. So that was just sort of the end of it for us at the time. And I've since gone back and rewatched a lot of TNG and some Deep Space Nine, but that was like, Next Generation is the core of it for me.
Yeah. Well, we all love to hate that episode of Voyager where they turn into salamanders by going faster than warp 10.
Right.
Like, why does that even make sense? Who thought of that?
Yeah, it feels sort of a cousin to the the TNG like de-evolution episode where it's like, okay, you like really don't want to think about the science at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a special one.
So back to your book. One of the main reasons that I had such a blast reading it is because I saw so many of my fellow scientists in it. You interviewed exactly the same people that I would have about this topic. Mohammed Noor, about evolution, Caleb Scharf, Sarah Walker, Nick Lane, Adam Frank. These are just people that I love reading their scientific works, like their papers. Mm-hmm. I love talking to them at science conferences. Jamie, was there a particular interview with a scientist that you did while researching the possibility of life that just sticks out to you for whatever reason?
Oh, yeah. I think it's probably two, and for two totally different reasons. So, I mean, just to give listeners some context, I am not a scientist. I don't have a PhD. I have an MFA in creative nonfiction, right? And when I was getting my MFA, took one undergrad astronomy class because I was able to sort of cross-register at the university, and I took Caleb's class on exoplanets and astrobiology. It's when he was at Columbia. And that was really helpful just to go into writing this book feeling like I had literally any academic background in the material, because it's not just about astronomy. I'm also writing about the origin of life and evolutionary biology and linguistics and all this stuff. And I wrote for Astrobites for a few years when I was in grad school, so I like have some background in the exoplanets and astrobiology stuff, but and like SETI and that stuff. But so I was coming into a lot of this very ignorant. And so being able to interview Caleb for the book was really meaningful to me because he was there at the beginning of my writing about these topics, learning about these topics, and he has been just such a meaningful supporter. Like, so when I emailed him to ask if I could take his class, there's a prereq for the class, which was calculus. And I was like, I can't do calculus. I did take calc in high school. And I was like, I have to take the class pass fail for my program anyway. So what if I brush up on calculus enough to be able to follow the lectures? And he so generously, when we were in the calc heavy section of the class, wrote me like short answer word questions, like where I could answer with a paragraph. And I only found out later that he's also a writer and he writes books. I just felt like he really like welcomed me into the field. So being able to quote him in the book is just very, very meaningful to me. And then the flip of that is interviewing Sarah Walker, where I don't know a single thing about the origin of life. I've never taken like biochem or any, like I don't even know what field. The origin of life is such a slippery discipline. I was like, okay, I kind of remember what, like, I know what RNA is, but someone says ribozyme and I'm like, uh-huh. And I'm like Googling. But her ideas are just so interesting and she is so fun to talk to and to brainstorm with and to like go out on a limb. And as a writer without academic background in a lot of these fields, as a woman who I think reads kind of young, you know, the reception from some researchers whom I was interviewing was sometimes a little skeptical or condescending. But it was really, really wonderful with like Sarah or with Jonathan Lassus, who's an evolutionary biologist, being able to like get excited about ideas together and like talk through, like Jonathan and I talked about like how life could exist on another planet without Darwinian evolution.
Yeah.
And we were just like, I don't know, it could be this, it could be that. He's like, maybe they're chimeras, you know, maybe it's horizontal gene transfer for everyone. It was just those sorts of fun, stimulating conversations. I'm not a good interviewer in terms of like letting the source do the talking and like asking dumb questions. Like I really just want to talk science with these people for better or worse. But it's really fun.
yeah, absolutely. Well, those two that you mentioned, so I don't know Jonathan, but Caleb, I know, and Sarah, I know, and yeah, I have the exact same enthusiasm about getting just a tiny slice of their time. They're both extraordinarily busy people, but whenever I get to talk to them about aliens, oh my goodness, it's so great.
Yeah, Jonathan wrote a really, really wonderful book called, I'm looking at it on my shelf to make sure I get the title right, Improbable Destinies, and it's about the question of convergent evolution. Yeah. And the beginning and end, like the intro and epilogue, both touch on aliens because it's a very important question when we're thinking about aliens. But for anyone who's interested in that, it's a really, really enjoyable read. And in it, he mentions that, like, maybe life on another world wouldn't even use Darwinian evolution. And I was like, what? Is that allowed? Mm-hmm. So I just emailed him and was like, can I ask you some questions? And then, you know, we did. So again, busy people very generously giving their time is like how books get written.
Yeah. And that idea of, I mean, because NASA's definition for life literally says something that does Darwinian evolution, right? And so to think outside that box, to break that paradigm, it almost takes that science fiction mind to do that, to say, you know, like, but what if, you know, it was so different.
And that's what defined a lot of the great conversations with researchers for me, is I was asking them to speculate. I was asking them to go beyond what you could publish and say, like, okay, but what do you think? Like, you could never say this in a journal paper. I mean, you could, but it would not, you shouldn't. But like, but what if? Like, what if we just like imagine? And it was really fun when people would go out on that limb with me.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you didn't know too much about the slippery subject of the origin of life, but that absolutely did not show in your book.
Okay.
You had such a cool boss chapter on the origin of life, going through all these different theories. I found the origin of life through my graduate studies, working with Dr. Mike Russell on the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory for the origin of life. And you mentioned in the book that that was also your first exposure to the origin of life was through that theory. And I found that it's actually not a very common one. Most people, I think, learn about the RNA world instead. So the two, just for our audience, the two competing hypotheses, the alkaline vents postulate that life originated at the bottom of the ocean, whereas the RNA world generally assumes some kind of like warm surface pond exposed to ultraviolet light and meteoritic infall and things like that. But the most interesting thing about your chapter on the origin of life to me was your conversation with Bill Martin, who cautioned you against falling in love with your first origin of life theory. And I felt cautioned by Bill while I was reading those works too, because every single day it's a fight for me to remind myself, wait, we don't actually know how life started. No matter how much you like the alkaline hydrothermal vent theory, you don't know that's the answer. So, Jamie, my question for you is, as a result of writing your chapter on the origin of life, have your views on the origin of life evolved? And has your devotion to the alkaline vent theory changed?
It hasn't. And I think that's because, so like, the RNA world idea, like another way to think about it is it's basically information first. That the first thing that happened was that molecules started being able to like contain within them the instructions for their replication. And the alkaline vent theory aligns up with metabolism first, or what first happened is within the little pores and vesicles of the rock structures, you get, because like cells, as in the areas, like contained spaces, are very important for concentrating materials. But the alkaline vent creates an energy differential so that there's essentially metabolism theoretically driving these reactions. You know, RNA world is definitely the dominant mainstream view. And I wonder, you know, I've never thought about this before, but maybe alkaline vents and metabolism first feel very compelling because the proponents have to make a stronger case because they're the underdog.
Oh, wow.
So the two ways that I was introduced to metabolism first were through an article about Mike Russell and Bill Martin's work by Tim Reckwarth that was published in Eon a few years ago. Tim is a friend of mine and just like one of the best science writers out there. So I encountered that, very well written. Mm-hmm. And then the other was through Nick Lane's book, The Vital Question, and also talking to Nick. And Nick is a remarkable writer and communicator. So I had great pitchmen for the idea, you know, like Nick is an evangelist for his ideas and for the importance of energy at the core of not just the origin of life, but evolution. And the book goes on to have, you know, chapters on the energetic requirements of sex and death and all sorts of, it's just a really cool book. And someone being a good writer helps a lot. Like I haven't read a great book or a great article on RNA World. And I think that might be because since it's the default, it's not as interesting to write about either for journalists or the practitioners.
Right, right. No, this is so true. I mean, sometimes I'll go to scientific conferences and people will postulate about the RNA world. And I'll ask some like just innocent question about like, how do you know that particular step in the theory of the RNA world is true? And the answer that I'll get back is because we're all here. And I'm like, what? Like,
yeah.
you're just assuming that this is, you know, exactly this was the way that it happened. And you almost like don't even feel the need to defend it. And so what you said really resonated with me about how as the underdog, the alkaline hydrothermal vent folks have to actually do a little bit more work trying to lift their theory against all of this scrutiny, whereas the RNA world folks maybe feel a little bit less of that responsibility.
Yeah. And I also, and this comes up with Sarah Walker and her colleague Lee Cronin, who are very uh-huh. focused on like an information theory origin of life that's much more abstracted from the specific chemistry. They are also both great, compelling speakers and communicators. And if there is that person for RNA World, I mean, it might be Steve Benner, but like, I don't know if I have found them, if I've stumbled across their work, because like in my writing, a consequence of not being a scientist and covering so many different disciplines in each chapter is that like you could write a whole book about the origin of life. I mean, about anything in the origin of life. You could write a whole mm-hmm. book about exoplanets, about convergent evolution, all of this stuff, like each chapter. So I was not always able to read super deeply. I just was like finding some interesting voices and perspectives. And I was like, cool, that's what this 6,000 words is about.
Well, despite your leanings towards the alkaline vent, I thought that the chapter was exquisitely balanced and I enjoyed reading it a lot. You got to include, you know, like you said, some of these bleeding edge theories from Sarah Walker and Lee Cronin about assembly theory and mm-hmm. how that's just a different way of looking at what life is and what life does. And so it was cool to see that research represented in the book as well.
Thanks. Yeah.
So let's move on to your chapter about animals, where you write about how different alien life could be, even going so far as to speculate that the mode of evolution on other worlds could be completely different from our own. And we spoke about this already, could it be non-Darwinian? Could there just be horizontal gene transfer that organisms tap into and just like trade genes the way that we put on different clothes in the morning? And then you say, quote, imagining alien life requires a leap of faith that's not just cognitive, but empathetic too. Not just assembling physiology, but believing in impulses and desires, perhaps even inner life. And we have enough trouble doing this on Earth, where the animals actually are our very different cousins. So, Jamie, when we have such a hard time empathizing with other life forms on our very own planet, you know, beings that we're actually related to, does this bode well for our ability to recognize the intrinsic value of alien life?
No. I mean, that's the answer. And there are people, you know, biologists, you get like whale scientists and researchers, dolphin researchers saying this exact thing at SETI conferences, also anthropologists bringing this up a lot, that like, whoa, we've got lots of alien species here on Earth. We have lots of alien intelligences here on Earth. Or even if we look at different human cultures, you know, like, I think this gets at a lot of the idealism in sci-fi and in SETI, the idea that like, once we meet aliens, we will rise to the occasion, you know, we will feel this unity on Earth and this kinship with the aliens. It's like, well, I hope so. And maybe that is the shock to the system that we need. But we also already know that there is a lot of life on Earth that we are treating very badly. And I don't know, like, we could just, you know, tend to our own backyard first, for sure.
And then in your chapter about people, you have this section about dolphin intelligence, which really struck me because I'm organizing a session at this year's Astrobiology Science Conference that has two papers submitted to it about whale languages. And I was completely shocked by this because the session is about looking for life, looking for biosignatures using information and complexity. And I knew that this was a pretty wide-ranging topic, but I had no idea that it would encompass whale songs. And then I thought, hey, wait a minute. As a Trekkie, I totally should have seen this coming. I mean, how could I possibly think that whale songs should be excluded when whale communication was like the subject of an entire Star Trek movie, right?
Yeah.
So I think this just speaks to the idea that science fiction can contribute a lot to the profound questions of what is intelligence, what is consciousness, what is personhood. These are questions that science still has no definitive answer to. And Jamie, I thought maybe you could riff on that since you spent a lot of time talking to dolphin experts.
Yeah, well, this is another thing where, like, it wasn't my innovation to bring dolphin researchers into the conversation. They're already very present in SETI. They have been from the beginning, from the 60s. And it's a very interesting test case because we have this, I said it before, but this alien intelligence, as one of the researchers puts it, they're not extraterrestrial, but they're non-terrestrial. And I think largely because they live in such a different environment, they've developed a very different kind of intelligence, different modes of communication. It's sonar, but it's not just sonar. Dolphins recognize each other by tasting each other's pee because they're just in the water and that's where the urine is, you know, which also, you know, you could open up a whole nother can of worms or go down a whole nother hallway about cultural norms and differences and, you know, how we would find that so repulsive if we met some clearly sentient, intelligent aliens who were like, yes, we drink each other's pee. It kind of reminds me of, you know, eating Klingon food, just like culturally embedded notions of disgust.
Right. But
it's really interesting to me because on the one hand, we have these very intelligent social animals who have very different senses and experiences of the world than we do, but may have sophisticated communication or language. And it's very hard for us to crack, right? This is not something like you pull out the phrase book because it's not just words and it's not spoken language. It seems like a very different way that language works.
Yeah.
But then there's the idea that, you know, on Earth, we are the dominant intelligent land living species, and they're the dominant intelligent ocean swimming species. And this goes back to convergent evolution again. If we met aliens from another planet who lived on land and breathed air, and, you know, you think about the best kinds of communication on air versus in water, it makes a lot of sense to use either very low sustained sounds or sonar. That's an important like spatial sense as well. But on land, like you're facing the same evolutionary challenges. You're trying to solve the same problems. It's entirely plausible that an intelligence that developed in a similar environment would be more similar to ours, a more similar mindset and worldview than the dolphins that develop their intelligence in water, even though we are pretty closely evolutionarily related.
Right. That makes sense. When you cast everything in an evolutionary perspective and you start thinking about evolution as life's ability to learn about its environment and adapt to specific problems in its environment, if you imagine an alien environment that presents evolving life on that other world with similar problems, maybe it will come up with similar solutions.
Yeah, it's like something that really blew my mind. One of the researchers told me is that dolphins don't have object permanence. If you put an object in a sonar opaque bucket, they don't know where it went. Because there aren't sonar opaque buckets in their environment. Like it just doesn't happen.
That makes sense.
Right? But like, there's a lot more visually opaque stuff than there is sonar opaque stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So humans had to develop object permanence because like stuff goes behind rocks all the time, but dolphins can sense through that often. So I don't know if rocks are actually sonar opaque, so don't hold me to that. But just these like things that seem so fundamental to basic intelligence to us. I don't know if crows have object permanence, but I would guess they do the way that they solve puzzles. And like, not that we need to be comparing and ranking who's more intelligent, but just that intelligence can be so different. Rather than just higher or lower, feels very important.
I completely agree. The more I learn about the fungal networks in forests and things like that, I start thinking about, wow, maybe intelligence can take all sorts of different forms. We're just really bad at recognizing them because we only think about ourselves as intelligent. And then we start to say, oh, dolphins are kind of like us, just a little bit different. So they can count as intelligent too, maybe crows, but then there could be all sorts of forms of, you know, intelligence in terms of just problem solving or, you know, communication that takes forms that we're completely unfamiliar with, like you said.
Yeah, which goes back to your question of like, how are we gonna do? Well, like if the aliens are very much like us, but if they're not, that could be a problem.
So let's talk about your chapter on technology now, where you introduce us to the Kardashev scale for civilizations, that civilizations can be classified by how expansive their energy use is. I've always thought that this was a little bit sketchy. I've questioned its usefulness. And I think that you do too, because this way of thinking seems to presuppose that we can linearly extrapolate humanity's doings over the past few centuries into the great unknown of outer space and the far future, you know, that what we've done is territorial expansion, colonization, resource extraction, that should just continue and perpetuate into outer space. But I think we got to question that, right? And you bring up this big question in your book about what are alternative ways of thinking about progress. You know, is it always greater technology, greater growth, greater dominance over nature, or can progress be something else?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was the anthropologist Catherine Denning, who I talked to for the book, who pointed out that it's not even just extrapolating from the last few hundred years of human civilization. It's extrapolating from one dominant culture's actions for the last few hundred years of human civilization, because there are current extant cultures on Earth. I mean, not as many as there used to be because we've gone around killing them, that don't focus on technological development, growth, acquisition. Like, it feels very capitalist to me. It feels very capitalist and militaristic and imperialistic. The idea that humans are explorers, humans spread, humans are colonists, essentially, and that the way to progress is to use more and more energy, more power in that sense, which our inclination to be doing that over the last 150 years has done some really bad things. So seeing that as the model for an advanced civilization, I mean, is the answer just to find clean energy sources, or is the answer to rethink your society's relationship with using power, with using energy? And, you know, dolphins come to mind as well, because if there was a super advanced dolphin civilization, because living in water makes technology development very different because you don't have hands and you can't have fire, right? Which maybe that's a closed-minded way of thinking about it, but you see tool making and the use of fire as really foundational early steps to human development. And fire is just an important, you know, is necessary for like all the early human technologies, you know, clay, smelting, et cetera, et cetera. What would a super advanced dolphin civilization look like? Would they just be poets? Would they be very caring for each other? Would they be philosophers? None of that shows up on the Kardashev scale. None of that is detectable across interstellar space. And you know, I really appreciate the astronomers who say that they're not looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're looking for extraterrestrial technology because that's what we can detect. So there are civilizations out there that could be entirely undetectable and could be very advanced. But I think it's not just about holding space for the other civilizations that might be out there. Like I said, in that bit of the prologue that I read, the ways that we imagine advanced civilizations are ways that we're imagining advancement for ourselves. And if the only kinds of advanced civilizations that we imagine are technological, are consuming energy at vast scales, are occupying more and more space on planets and whatnot, like that shouldn't be the only story that we tell ourselves. And that actually brings me back to Star Trek, because embedded in the world building of Star Trek is the fact that life on Earth has become advanced, not just in technological ways, but in the eradication of poverty, of money, maybe, right? Like yeah. I'm not really up to date on all the lore and backstory, but my understanding is that after World War III, mm-hmm. life on Earth goes through some really big, pretty anti-capitalist changes.
Yeah.
I think war has been eliminated, you know, and so that's why the storytelling faces outward, because that's where there is still much conflict and strife. It is also very telling that we don't see life on that almost utopian future Earth as being rich for storytelling, because it's like they've solved all their problems, you know, that gets into all sorts of other things. But like Star Trek really sneaks in this idea of there are other ways to think about advancement. We also meet alien cultures where their advancement is a kind of spiritual transcendence or transcending the physical body. Mm-hmm. But the main species that we meet are warlike, are competing. It's, you know, battles, and especially when we move into Deep Space Nine, political power. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it makes sense that those are the other species that the humans are engaging with a lot, because we can understand them, right? Like we can't follow Q when he's not embodied as Q, because that's incomprehensible to us. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, you know, it becomes this sort of self-limiting cycle as well.
Yeah, let's keep talking about Star Trek and talk about the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let me just say that as cozy and familiar as the first few chapters of your book seem to me, because I'm a planetary scientist, astrobiologist, I think about, you know, other worlds and the origin of life, the last couple of chapters dealing with more of these societal, cultural, civilization level things were really new and exciting to me. And I love how you introduce all these anthropologists and historians to your writing in these last couple of chapters. And there was one part where there was this almost like back and forth critique about the Prime Directive in Star Trek. So for our audience, if anybody's not familiar with the Prime Directive, it's the Federation's principle that they should not interfere with the natural development of any pre-warp civilizations that they encounter. And one of the scholars in your book notes that this might be a reflection of our own guilt of colonization, our own history, this troubled history that we've had on planet Earth. Whereas another scholar thinks that the Prime Directive is still kind of in line with colonial leanings, because it can be seen as a way of oppressing those who aren't worthy or advanced enough to join the Federation. And so after having these kinds of conversations, Jamie, how do you feel about the Prime Directive in Star Trek?
I think I lean with I end up with the former, where interfering just doesn't tend to go well. You know, I'm thinking about a book that I write about in the last chapter, The Sparrow by Mary Deria Russell, which was inspired by the 500th anniversary of Columbus coming to the Americas, and written with the fraught idea of what would have happened if something like that happened with like the best of intentions. And even still, it goes wrong. You know, the idea is that we get a signal, or we catch a signal, sort of overhearing a transmission coming from a planet, I think around Alpha Centauri, maybe Proxima, which shows up in sci-fi all the time because it's only 4 light years away. And everyone's like, that's pretty close. And while the world governments are figuring out what to do, the Catholic Church sends a Jesuit mission, you know, with the very sincere, genuine goal of knowing God's other children. And even with the best of intentions, and even though the alien languages are very learnable by humans, the aliens that they meet are open to meeting us, the aliens, it doesn't go well, I'll just say. But, you know, it really gets into the fraughtness of what something going well even means. So, I mean... Yeah, it's really an impossible question in the end. Like, are we denying them technology? Because so many of our stories, our sci-fi stories of encountering advanced civilizations, involve them helping us somehow, you know, especially in like the first wave of SETI in the 60s, 70s, 80s. This shows up in Carl Sagan's writing and speaking a lot. The idea that they might have some kind of infinitely renewable energy source that they could tell us about, or some sociopolitical advances that could help us move past all the strife that we see on Earth. So we want to be saved. But then we turn that around with the Prime Directive saying like, well, you got to do it yourselves. But then isn't that the beauty of imagining a diverse cosmos, is that all of these worlds develop in very different ways.
Yeah.
And there is a real flattening of culture that we see on Earth when a dominant culture comes into another space. You see that in Ursula Le Guin's Hainish cycle, which is set on a bunch of worlds that billions of years ago were seeded or sort of sent in a certain direction by this ancient civilization on a planet called Hain. So that on different worlds, slightly varied descendants of the people on Hain would develop. And Earth is one of those worlds, and there are others. And one of the beautiful things is seeing how the different worlds develop, seeing all their different kinds of culture, seeing the slightly different evolutionary adaptations despite this common origin, although some of them are also like genetically tweaked. And it's just like, even with this common origin, these like this shared history, it's really beautiful to see like all the different ways that culture and people in the broad sense can be.
Oh, I love that so much. I want to ask about artificial intelligence now, because it's all the rage. And you note in your book...
Making faces. I'm making faces for the listeners.
So you note in your book that AI is often the villain in so much of sci-fi. This is especially true in Star Trek. We've got malicious computers in the original series, the Borg in The Next Generation and Voyager, and in Star Trek Discovery, this malicious AI called Control that sort of takes over Section 31 and threatens all of biological life in the galaxy. One might say that villainous AI kind of reflects our present moment, where these large language models are threatening to take all of our jobs, destabilize lots of society, from education to art, even in science. But AI has been kind of at the core of sci-fi stories long before ChatGPT took the stage. So, Jamie, what do you think it is about AI that we fear so much?
I mean, I think in a lot of ways it represents our very fraught relationship with technology, the idea that technology dehumanizes us, or just the rapid pace of change is alarming in a lot of ways. And the way that our experience of the world and our sense of the world and scale and time changes. It's that Luddite impulse in all of us. And technology has been taking away jobs, you know, since the Luddites. So I think it's partly that. I think it's something that Rose Eveleth pointed out to me when I spoke to them for the book. And they, you know, for a long time had a podcast about different imaginings of the future.
Yeah, I was on that show, actually.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Yeah.
So a little synergy here. So Rose pointed out something really smart, which is like, when you look at the people today who are talking, I mean, not in the ChatGPT sense, but the like the futurists who are most scared of AI and the singularity, it's people like Elon Musk and Ray Kurzweil, and it's these guys who work in tech. And Rose pointed out that the thing they're imagining is that the only thing that they're scared of is their own creation. You know, which is like, oh, It really, I found, deflates a lot of those fears about the whole singularity and everything. Also, the fact that, like, Kurzweil wrote The Singularity is Near, like, 30 or 40 years ago. And I swear he's coming out with a new book that's, like, The Singularity is Nearer or something. It's like, Ted Chiang has written essays about AI in The New Yorker over the last couple of years. And I really find that he articulates my feelings, which is, like, this is not intelligence, that we have no reason to think that what we're seeing today is at all approaching any kind of generalist intelligence, which is what humans have and what makes us what we are. I find like so much irritation about ChatGPT and Midjourney and all that stuff, not just because I'm a writing teacher and I have to now keep an eye out for my students using ChatGPT to do their assignments, which, because I really think that someone in the tech world really won an early battle by convincing us to call these programs AI and not machine learning. They are clever plagiarism algorithms. They are not intelligent. They are not creating anything new. They are glitching. They are averaging out all of their inputs. We keep hearing so many stories about the human discernment that's necessary behind them. There's no intelligence there. And yeah, the ways that they are coming for the devaluing art and human creativity, like they cannot be creative. There's no new idea in there. And I find that very infuriating. But I think it's entirely separate, other than in name, from these future visions of the singularity, of actual machine intelligence that is a very powerful boogeyman. I think in Star Trek too, it is a foil to so much of what we think about as the essence of humanity. One of my favorite tropes in sci-fi is when an alien tells us what they see in humanity. Like, what is humanity's thing? You know, in Contact, I think it's that we have so much love. In Octavia Butler's novel Dawn, it's that we are competitive and hierarchical, which the intelligent aliens are not. And, you know, we want this outside view, this outside mirror, because we're the only example that we have. And so we want to know how we fit into a broader context. On Star Trek, it's really funny because every other main character species has one quality. Vulcans are logical. Klingons are barbaric. Romulans are mean or whatever. Romulans just don't. But, you know, like there's one quality, and then humans are just like a mix of all those things. And so the AI, the Borg foil, is they are heartless and emotionless and not individual. You know, they're collective. And, you know, the episodes where a Borg is sort of unborged, right? It's when they learn to use I. It's when they learn to see themselves as an individual. Mm-hmm. I think that also probably has some sort of old anti-communist baggage, right? The fear of being in the collective,
right?
Which is really at odds with like all the other ethos of Next Generation. But, you know, baggage is baggage. But yeah, I think that it's a lot of those things all swirled together.
Yeah, that was really insightful to see AI sort of as like the foil to what a lot of science fiction is positing is what we are, what makes humanity special. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So getting towards the end of your book, you talk about how the possibility of complex life, you know, that might be rare in the universe, life like us, but simple life might be very common. And then you write, quote, "Would a cosmos full of planets inhabited only with sludge make us feel like we weren't alone? A weird thing happened when I was writing this book. I realized I sort of ceased to care." End quote. Yeah. Jamie, tell me about this shift in your frame of mind and how writing the book precipitated it.
Well, I go into the book with the idea that I'm not going to look at the odds. I'm not going to ask whether or not, is it likely, is it rare? I'm just going to like imagine and look at, as it says in the title, the possibilities. And doing that required learning a lot about life on Earth, about the origin of life, about evolutionary biology, about cognition. And it really got me thinking really deeply about other kinds of life on Earth. You know, a friend who is a mostly like a sort of biology and natural history type writer read this and said, "You turned me into a space person while I was reading this." And I said, "Well, that's funny because reading it kind of turned me into a biology person." Mm. You know, finishing the book, I felt very done writing about aliens, and all I want to write about now is the origin of life and like, you know, early evolution, because that is just so amazing to me. And I think it was really just recognizing how amazing life on Earth is, that it holds so many mysteries and so much fascination and so much wonder. Reading Nick Lane's book was a big part of this. He writes so beautifully about how ATP works in our cells.
Yeah.
And like, I learned the Krebs cycle in high school. Okay. I'm like, I got it. And his new book, which I haven't read yet, is just about the Krebs cycle and the wonder of this incredibly complex machinery in all of our cells. I just think it's amazing. And we have so much of that life right here, and so much kinship to find with life on Earth, and so much to learn about ourselves and how our brains work. And I think all of my research really hit home how hard it might be to know what's out there, and how, like, you know, just like the AI researchers are like, "Oh, we'll be singularity in 20 or 30 years. Like, no matter when they're writing, it's always 20 or 30 years away. You see that a lot in SETI. You see in 1980, 1990, today, people saying, "Oh, I think 20 to 25 years, we'll know." It's like, well, or we won't. And we have no idea, like absolutely no idea. And I think I just found peace with that not knowing. And I don't know, like I said, it just like it didn't matter as much. Like I'm looking out my window right now behind the computer and like looking at the trees and a couple of birds and squirrels. I'm just like, that's amazing. I also, while I was writing the book, did move from the city to the suburbs. So maybe this is just like, I have a backyard. Did you guys know about birds? They're so cool. So it might also have been part of that.
But I love that thought, that profound thought, the peace of not knowing.
Yeah.
Peace with not knowing.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, that's very deep. And what you said about SETI and looking for extraterrestrial life, and it's always like 20, 30 years away, right? I feel like the same is true about the origin of life as well. I've heard, you know, people say, oh yeah, we're going to find out soon. You know, we're going to have the answer soon. But the origin of life is this historical science where we may never know what actually happened 4 billion years ago on planet
Earth.
Yeah,
and most people I talk to in that field actually say that they're not trying to answer the historical question, that answering the historical question is impossible, that they're more trying to understand how life arises in general, which will then provide information about how that might have happened on Earth. But, you know, going back to the first chapter and what we were talking about earlier, unless you have Q zapping you back onto the ancient Earth saying right here in this little pond, there they go.
Right.
We're never going to know. And that's part of why I find that field so fascinating, is just like with SETI and astrobiology, there are many impossible, unanswerable questions. And I guess it took me writing this book to sort of make peace with the unanswerable astrobiology questions and to develop a lot of skepticism about people who think that there's an answer right around the corner, or that like discovery will be sudden. That's the other thing, is like,
yeah,
it's going to be very gradual. But with origin of life, I still just find it so fascinating. All these scientists tinkering in their labs, mixing this and that, and seeing if you get the next step in a process that is entirely hypothetical. I don't know. I just, yeah, it's really interesting.
This is so funny and beautiful how you, in the process of writing this book, went from really looking out there for signs of alien life and then deciding, you know, I'm okay. I have peace with not knowing. And then you're going back to the origin of life. And I started out in astrobiology thinking about the origin of life, and then found my peace with not really knowing that historical question, and thought, you know what I could do is maybe like do a lot of biosignature research, because we are constantly sending things to Mars. We're going to send things to Europa. And so I swung the other way. And now most of my research is in the biosignatures realm. So I think it's so cool and beautiful how we're sort of crossing
and
in the middle
also,
here. I mean, astrobiology is so fun.
Yeah. And yeah. I also used to not care about life detection in the solar system. I was like, Mars, Europa, whatever. I was like, I want to know about other planets. But because the origin of life questions are so tied into the local questions, you know, exchange of materials between Mars and Earth in the early solar system, like my view has really narrowed and localized.
Wow. This has been so fun, Jamie, but we're running out of time. So let me ask a few last questions. What is one work of science fiction that you either discovered or rediscovered during the process of writing The Possibility of Life?
This is so hard, because a rule that I made for myself was that of all the sci-fi I write about, I didn't want to write about anything that I didn't love. I made a couple of exceptions. I mentioned Avatar. I don't love that movie. And I have mixed feelings about Solaris by Stanisław Lem, because it's just like so mid-century male. But everything else that I write about in the book, I loved. So this is so hard to pick one. I'm going to go with the one that I hear discussed least, because I think I just stumbled across it. It's called A Darkling Sea by James L. Cambias.
Okay.
And it is set on a icy moon in the subsurface ocean in another solar system. And there's a native sentient species of basically super intelligent, like lobsters, I think. Because it's totally lightless. And so they use sonar for sensing and communication. So it goes back to what we were talking about dolphins. They get all of their energy from hydrothermal vents. They get chemical energy and have like little farms down there. It's just so richly imagined. And it's also a really fun book. It has a lot of heart. It's funny. It's like a romp. And I was just really glad that I stumbled across it, and it fits so nicely in with that discussion of like different kinds of senses and different kinds of people.
Wow. I'm definitely going to have to go pick that one up.
It's great.
Can't wait for Sentient Lobsters.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Jamie, are there any upcoming projects that you'd like to plug for our audience?
Upcoming is still very mysterious for me. The Magic 8 Ball is saying, check again later. But after the book came out, I've published a couple of pieces that are sort of relevant to what we've talked about. So I wrote a piece for Eon about how we're not going to have an aha moment when we find extraterrestrial life. We might never know what we have found. And then going to this idea of the origin of life and NASA's, no one could see me rolling my eyes when you talked about NASA's working definition that involves Darwinian evolution. Like, how are you going to know that? How are you ever going to know that? But okay, that's why it's just a working definition. But the idea of the futility of having a definition of life, and researchers like Sarah Walker and Lee Cronin, who are looking for a theory of life, like a scientific theory, which I find really, really fascinating. And I wrote about that for The Atlantic, and that was a couple months ago. So I only have recent past projects to plug, unfortunately, but yeah, I'm working on it.
That sounds good. I'll go find those pieces, give them a good read, and then put them in the show notes for our audience.
Thanks.
Yeah. And last question is, where can people follow you on the internet?
So let's see. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky, all with the username Jamie Elise, which please put in the show notes because my parents spelled it all weird. Okay. And I also have a newsletter, which sometimes has, you know, little essays and musings, and also all of my updates. And people can sign up for that at my website, which is jamiegreen.net.
Awesome. Well, with that, thank you so much, Jamie, for joining me on Strange New Worlds. This was such a pleasure. I really enjoyed your book again, and it was even more fun to chat with you about it.
Thank you. Yeah, this was a blast.
I can't stop thinking about how Jamie was convinced to think deeper about the origins of life by writing about looking for life in the universe, while I was convinced to work on better ways for looking for life in the universe by thinking about the origins of life. This, to me, is a reflection of a very profound and important idea, that the study of the origins of life and the study of biosignatures are really two sides of the same coin. For example, say you want to make life out of non-living ingredients in the lab. In order to figure out if you've had a successful experiment, you need to have a robust way to tell if what you made was life. In other words, you need a reliable test for finding life. And say that you're an astrobiologist and you've just found life on another world, a biosphere that arose independently from ours on Earth. That profound discovery helps constrain our understanding of the probability of, and potentially the processes behind, what drives life into existence in the first place. Intrigued? I hope so, because next time on Strange New Worlds, we're going to talk all about the origin of life with University of Cambridge professor Paul Rimmer, dissecting that awesome scene where Q takes Picard back in time to the origin of life on Earth in the TNG episode All Good Things. Until then, take care, stay curious, and I'll see you out there.
But ultimately, we can only speculate about how we fit into the galactic picture. Through it all, our visions of alien worlds are reflections of our... sorry, page turn really messed that up.